Today's presenter is Michael Chang. Michael is currently the development lead for the WebSphere Application Server System Management. He has been involved in WebSphere Application Server since its inception and has been contributing to system management architecture and development since release 5.0.2, including incremental cell upgrades, mixed release cells, and JMX interoperability. As part of his role, he is the leader of a development lab task force that is focused on WebSphere scalability and large cell management. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Michael.
Thank you, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I hope everybody has a chance to get the presentation. So let's start from page 2, the agenda for this presentation. So first, the goal for the presentation, what I would like to convey to you and what I hope you will get out from this presentation. And then after that, we will start to talk about the large cell topology issues, issues including whether or not you should have one or many cells. For each cell, what are the constraints? How does the large cell topology impact your particular application server? How does it impact the way that you use a cell in terms of the topology that you use and the WebSphere components that you're using? And then we will go through the ZOS considerations and then end with a few sample topologies from real customers. Okay, moving on to page 3, the goal of this presentation. What I would like to convey to you is the various aspects of WebSphere that relates to the size of the cell, that there are certain internal components in WebSphere that you might or might not be using, and if you use them, then they would impact how you can manage your cell and how you grow the cell. It doesn't mean that you cannot grow the cell. It just means that there are some best practices that you will need in order to create a large cell, and that would be the major focus of this presentation. If you follow these best practices and plan ahead, you should be able to grow a cell into a very large size. Going on to slide number 4, this presentation is actually based on a white paper. I believe that it will be published sometime by the end of this week, probably Thursday. The white paper is a result of a task force, which I am currently the chair, and we have representatives from various WebSphere community, including development, testing, performance team, and support team. And our goal is to, on a continuing basis, discuss large topology issues and what we can do in WebSphere to help the customer create a large cell. We are also chartered with the mission of communicating the results both externally to you, the customer, and internally to WebSphere developers to ensure that as we continue with our architectural changes, that we keep large topology in mind and that, first of all, that we do not regress existing functions, and second, that we introduce new features to make it possible for customers to create ever larger topology. Okay, moving on to slide number 5. This is a recap of the existing WebSphere topology. In the current WebSphere network deployment cell, there is a central deployment manager. The function of the deployment manager is to keep track of the configuration for the cell and to manage the different nodes in the cell through JMX operations. So if you look at this slide, you can see that there is a cell-wide configuration repository. These are XML files that the deployment manager uses to store the configuration for the entire cell. When a user makes a change to the topology, the configuration files are performed and modified through the deployment manager. The The Note and the WebSphere are hosted through Note agents, and the Note agents would come to the deployment manager to get configuration changes. The configuration changes could be done through what we call NodeSync utility, or they could be fetched periodically by the Note agent. On each of the nodes, the configuration of the nodes are synchronized, and only those configurations that's needed by the node is synchronized to the node. So in this example, node A would contain the configuration for its node and the servers inside the node, and node B, when it performs synchronization, would then fetch only those files that it needs for the node agent and its server. There are also some cell-level specific documents that's needed by all the nodes, and these configuration files are synchronized as well. So these are configuration operations. In addition to that, the deployment manager through JMX can perform additional runtime operations. So for example, you can use it to start and stop servers through the node agent. You can use it to install and then start and stop applications. Going on to slide number 6, when you are on a machine with multiple LPARs, logical partitions, it is typical that different LPARs can be used for WebSphere nodes. So in our example here, there are multiple numbers of LPARs, and a WASP node is created for each LPAR. However, this is not a one-to-one ratio. That is, if the LPAR is defined in such a way that it has more capacity than a single node, or that if you want isolation amongst the nodes, then it is possible to create more than one WebSphere node and put them in the same LPAR. Going on to slide number 7. So how do you decide whether or not you need one or more cells? Some of these are considerations that are dependent on your organization. So for example, maybe you want to have an isolation between your production and your testing, which is always a good practice. So in those cases, you will want to create more than one cell. Maybe you have the need that you want to allow different departments to control their own WebSphere environment. And in that case, you might also want to consider more than one cell. Other issues that come up would include whether or not you can actually manage a very large cell. So if you grow your cell to 1,000 application servers, for example, or maybe 2,000, and you're hosting hundreds or more applications on it, is it the case that you are able to manage such a large environment and at the same time to be able to keep track of all the different pieces of information in such a large environment? I think the answer is actually differs depending on the kinds of applications that you will be running. So if you have collaborating applications and you all that you need is a large topology to host replicas of the application, then it will be a simple matter of creating a very large topology and just hosting these applications, for example. However, you have many, many unrelated applications, and from the admin console, you can see that there are hundreds and hundreds of applications, but they are unrelated, then it might become cluttered. Even if you try to filter them, it might actually require some mental model to try to keep track of which applications that you're working with. And if there's a lot of information that you need to keep track of, then it might become easier for you to separate them out into different cells. Another consideration is availability. There are some customers who actually create more than one cell for absolute isolation purposes. So for example, if you worry that perhaps a erroneous change to your cell could somehow impact the functioning of the cell, then it's a good practice that you create two cells such that if you somehow bring down one cell, that you still have the other cell available for your production environment. So as you can see, there are many, many different issues related to whether or not you should create one or more cells. And many of these issues are related to the organization that you're in and the practices that you want to enable for your organization. And on top of that, of course, there are limits in terms of what the application server infrastructure can provide. And those are the issues that we will concentrate for this presentation. Going on to slide number 8. So let's start from the basics, and that is how many applications should you run on an application server? There is actually a practical trade-off here. There is no single answer, right? So if you want to ensure that you have maximum resource utilization, then it's better that you run more than one application per application server. And the reason for this is pretty simple, that for each application server, there are some overhead that you need to pay for that server, and that includes the JVM itself, and that includes the WebSphere runtime, where the runtime includes the container and the administrative runtime, the security runtime, and so on. So by running multiple applications per application server, you can amortize the cost of the overhead amongst different applications, and that would get you better resource utilization, and that would allow you to run more applications with fewer resources. Now, the trade-off here is that there is less isolation between the applications. So if you have a misbehaving application, that misbehaving application could impact the performance, the throughput, and so on of that particular JVM, and one misbehaving application can then potentially impact all the other applications that are on the same server. On the other hand, if you have debugged your application well enough and that it's behaving correctly and that it's robust and so on, then there are advantages to putting them into the same application server. So we talked about the fact that you can amortize the cost of the runtime. One other benefit of running multiple applications is that if you have applications that call each other, by running them in the same JVM, you don't have to pay for the cost of going out of the process. That if you configure your workload management, for example, to prefer local, then you actually have a much higher performance environment compared to if you were to locate your applications in different application servers. Going on to slide number 9. So as we move up from the application server itself to the node, how many application servers can you run on a node? There's no real practical limit today in terms of what WebSphere allows you to do. It mostly has to do with the amount of physical resources that you have available on your node, and that boils down to the amount of memory. We want to keep the application servers performing well, and what this means is that you need to tune your application servers' heap size so that all the applications can run well without crashing, without requiring more swapping of virtual memory into disk. So once you figure out the amount of memory that you need for your applications, and then you figure out the number of application servers that you're running, then you can figure out the amount of resource requirements. So that what you should do is to ensure that you only run the number of application servers as would fit into your physical memory. So we do have cases where if you're on a Windows machine, maybe you can run a few application servers. If you're on a ZOS machine or P-Series machine, where you can run hundreds of application servers, it all boils down to how much memory that you can that you have for your node or your machine, and that will dictate the number of application servers. going on to slide number 10. How many nodes can you have per cell? Today, there is really no design limit to the number of nodes in a cell. However, there are practical limits in terms of the number of nodes. So we talked about before where the deployment manager is the central point of control, and that the nodes would come in to the deployment manager to fetch for configuration changes. At the same time, the deployment manager is also the central point of control for sending requests, GMX requests, to the applications and application servers in the nodes. At the same time, there are also notifications that would come back from the nodes and the servers to the deployment manager. So as you can see, because of the amount of traffic that is going on between the deployment manager and the nodes and the servers, that as the number of nodes increases, the amount of traffic would increase. So in order to make the deployment manager function well and the topology function well, it means that there are some tuning and best practices that needs to be done in order for all the different nodes to function in this environment. So one example is that if you have many nodes that you can consider trying to increase the time interval in which the nodes will come into the deployment manager to look for configuration changes, assuming that you have all those things turned on. Many customers actually choose to turn off all those things, and they rely on specific actions to control when synchronization gets performed onto the nodes. Another potential tuning that could be done is to reduce the amount of notifications that would flow back from the application servers to the nodes and then to the deployment manager. So again, for the most part, the number of notifications are limited by default to only the important ones, such as getting notifications about synchronization changes due to application install, which is needed by the application client in order to determine when an application install has occurred successfully. There are other notifications that you can turn on for performance monitoring that you can turn on to listen for log messages. So these kinds of notification could actually generate quite a bit of traffic, and you need to be able to determine how to focus your parameters for turning on these notifications so that you do not generate a flood of notifications from all the servers, because once you do that, then you start to overwhelm the deployment manager, and the deployment manager will likely run out of memory and start to suffer and perhaps even crash. However, if you are careful and you use the default behavior today, which is to limit the number of notifications, then you are able to manage the deployment manager with many nodes and servers in the environment. Okay, going on to slide number 11. So what are the portions of the WebSphere architecture that can limit the size of your WebSphere cell? The simple answer to that is that it depends on the components that require shared information between the application servers. So in a distributed environment, as you try to share information between the different application servers, you would require, you would have to incur communication costs, and you would have to incur CPU costs. As the number of application servers increases, and if those application servers require the same share information, then you would be incurring more and more of these additional costs as you increase the topology size. So how big you can create a cell actually depends on whether or not your application requires these services. In terms of the particular components that are impacted by the cell size. The main component that we're going to be talking about for this presentation is the High Availability Manager. The High Availability Manager is the component that's introduced in Webster 6.0, and it is used to communicate, share information that could be used by workload management, by proxy server, and by session replication components and Dynacache components. We'll be talking about this in a lot more detail in the following slides. Another place where there is shared information, of course, is through systems administration. We have already talked about how we need to communicate the configuration file changes and notifications and JMX operations. So there are some best practices that we already talked about and more to come in the following slides. And then another component that we will try to cover is security. What are the factors that impact security performance, and what do we need to do and the best practices in order to make security runtime behave more efficient? Okay, we're done with slide number 11. So let's move on to slide number 12. So we talked about the HA Manager as a major component in WebSphere 6. The HA Manager is a new component that is used for high availability services. If you look into the computer science literature and you search for something called group communications or distributed consistency, that is basically what the HA Manager is implementing underneath the covers. So in a distributed environment, there are requirements in order to reach consensus amongst the different processes. So for example, some of the consensus that you might want to reach are who are the members of my group, which are the group members down, who is the primary serving a particular service in my group, who is the secondary. So these are the kinds of consensus that needs to be reached amongst the different distributed processes in this environment. And the HA Manager underneath the covers uses something called RMM, which is a reliable multitasking protocol, and DCS, the distribution and consistency services, in order to implement the distributed consistency. Once you have a distributed consistency, then you can start to build services on top of it. And the WebSphere services that we build on top of that includes messaging engine. It includes workload management. It includes domain replication service. It includes transaction service. And it includes on-demand configuration. So for the message engine, it uses the HA Manager to perform failover. That is, once you know which process is no longer available, then and there's a consensus among the groups or clusters in your environment, then you can migrate the message engine onto a different member of the cluster and restart our messaging. Workload management uses the HA Manager to determine which servers are up or down. Again, it's a distributed consistency protocol. Workload management gets notified whenever a server goes up or whenever a server goes down, and then the client of the workload management gets receives the information and uses that to update its internal routing tables and then perform the routing decisions based on that new information. The domain replication service uses the information to propagate state information. There are different configurations for DRS, but by using the HA Manager service, it is able to determine which servers are up or down, and then it would determine whether or not to go to the backup or other replicas to fetch the information and to store the information for a distributed hash map kind of operation. The transaction service, again, uses the HA Manager to determine how to perform transaction recovery. If a application server is currently running and it's performing a two-phase transaction, And if the application server fails, or even if the machine actually fails, then the transaction service uses the ATM manager to migrate the transaction service onto a different application server and then complete the in-progress transaction. The on-demand configuration component, again, uses the ATM manager to determine which servers are up or down, and it uses that information to perform HTTP-based routing. So as you can see, there are many, many components of WebSphere that require the use of the ATM manager, and if your application requires the use of these functions, then you will be impacted by the performance and the scalability of the ATM manager itself. Okay, going on to slide number 13. So the ATM manager itself is quite network and sometimes CPU intensive, because it has to run a pretty complex algorithm underneath the covers in the DCS and RMM layer in order to determine what the members of its group are and to determine which server is up or down. In terms of the amount of number of sockets that it requires, it's a mesh connection, and it requires about n squared minus n connections between the application servers. That is, every application server talks to each other. What this means is that there are some practical limits to the number of application servers that you can create in this particular group environment. As the number of JVM increases, the number of network connections increases geometrically, n squared, and it cannot be sustained for a very large topology. There are some optimizations that has been incorporated into WebSphere 6.1. However, these are optimizations that do not reduce the N-square requirements, and therefore the limits on the topology still exist. Okay, going on to slide number 14. As you start to increase the number of application servers for the ATM manager environment, there are several configuration properties that would need to be looked at in terms of increasing timeout, increasing number of retries, and increasing amount of memory in order for them to work in a larger group environment. So these are the different parameters for the Harvey intervals for the number of misses that the ATM manager would sustain before marking the server as down, and for determining the buffer size and the stack data size for the ATM manager component. Okay, so going on to slide number 15. Even if you try to increase the heartbeat intervals and memory sizes and so on, there are still practical limits to the number of members that you can create in one ATM manager group, what we call the core group. There's no one answer that can tell you how many members you can have in a core group. It actually depends on the particulars of your hardware. So if you're on a cheap Windows machine, maybe you can put on 10 or 20. If you're on a big P-series box, you might go up to 100. For many customers on average hardware, we found that about 50 is the practical limit, in that once you go beyond that, then you have to start to look into other ways of configuring your cell in order to make it perform well. Okay, so what kind of problem can we run into if we create a very large core group? Some of the problems we run into are the number of sockets. So we talked about that the number of sockets is n squared minus n, right? So if you have a core group of 200 JVMs, then you need almost 40,000 sockets. However, if you split that into 50 members in one core group and four core groups, then you will require only 9,800 sockets. Once you start to increase the number of members in a core group, then you can start to see some potential problems. Some of these problems include taking a long time to start up a large core group, or that if you change the configuration of your core group or core group members, that some of the JDM might shut down because they could not reach a consensus among the different core group members. So what we need to do is to ensure that you experiment with your environment and that you can determine the number of core group members that you can fit into your particular environment. There are some other limitations for core groups. For example, you cannot locate the members of core group on a different side of the firewall, and that it's not recommended that you locate the machines in the core group on a wide area network, that they should be connected by a high-speed network because of the heartbeat requirements amongst different members. Going on to site number 60, so what do we do when we find that the core group has become too large and that it's starting to become unstable? What we do is that we create partition of core groups such that they are multiple core groups, and then we bridge them together. So in this particular example, there is there are four different core groups, and as an example, let's say that we start with our original 200 application servers, and then we partition them into four different core groups where there are 50 members inside each core group. Now, because of the need for shared information, we still need an infrastructure in order to propagate that shared information between the different core groups. So, for example, if you have an application in core group 1 that needs to call through workflow management into an EJB in core group 2, you still need to share that information about which members of core group 2 are up or down so that your application in core group 1 is able to use workflow management routing to route the request to core group 2. So because of the need for shared information, we define something called a core group bridge. A core group bridge allows you to bridge different core groups together and send the shared information amongst the different core groups. And you do this by defining what we call a core group access point and a access point group. A core group access point, there's one per core group, and it's the point where the different core groups are bridged together. A core group access point contains what we call bridge interfaces, and the bridge interfaces reside inside a member. There could be more than one. So they could reside on one member of the core group, or you can have more than one bridge interface, and then they will reside on multiple members of the core group. In this particular topology, we call it mesh topology, the different access points all talk to each other. So in effect, they form what is very similar yet to another core group, and the members of the access point group will talk to each other. And this is a higher performance protocol because of the mesh topology allows every member to talk to every other member, which means that the propagation of information is faster. The disadvantage of this topology is that it suffers the same shortcoming as the core group, in that there's a limit to the number of members you can have inside your access point group. So if you look at all the bridge interfaces, they should not exceed 50 because it's the same underlying infrastructure and it has the same scaling limitations as the regular core group. So what this means is that assuming that we can have 50 members per core group and that we can have 50 core group access points, it means that you can probably scale up to about 2,500 application servers before this topology starts to break down. Of course, you might be able to scale up more as the hardware that you're running becomes better. Going on to site number 17, another topology that can be used to bridge the different core groups together is what we call a chain topology. In this case, and we have group access, core group access points defined for each core group. However, we define multiple numbers of access point groups. So in this case, we define an access point group between any two adjacent core groups in this picture. The advantage of this is that they can scale pretty much indefinitely because as you create more and more core groups, you just create more and more of these chains. However, the problem here is that as you increase the number of links in your chain, the amount of time that's needed to propagate information between the chains becomes longer. So in our example, let's say that core group 1 wants to call an EJB in core group 3. Now, the servers in core group 3 are going up or down, or the configurations are changing, and that will trigger a change of information about the routing information that workload management needs. So that routing information will then be propagated from core group access point 3 inside core group 3, and that needs to be propagated all the way to core group 1. So depending on the number of members that you have in the links and the number of chains you have, it might not happen. Of course, it won't happen instantaneously, but as the number of chain increases, the amount of time that you need to propagate that information increases. So what this means is that there's a timing window in core group 1 where it does not react to the changes in core group 3. And as the number of chain increases, the timing window increases. Another vulnerability of the chain is that if you suffer from more than one failure, that your chain can break in such a way that you now have partitioning between your core groups. So if there is a break in the chain, if there are two breaks in the chain, then the chain becomes severed, and then the information would not be available between the different core groups. This is not as bad as it sounds because the best practice is to define more than one bridge per core group access point, and that in a practical environment, multiple failure does not occur all that often. Okay, going on to slide number 18, in terms of the best practices recommendations, you should avoid one large core group. So by default, WebSphere puts all the application servers into a single default core group. Once you start to grow yourself, and if you start to go beyond that magical limit, whether it's 25 or 50, and you start to see some instability, then it's time to start to think about defining multiple core groups. Of course, the best practice once you start to do that is that you want to partition yourself into a small number, into several core groups where the number of members in a core group are small, 25 to 50 range. You can experiment and grow that up to 75 or 100, depending on the hardware that you're running. If you are not using the HA services, and you know many of you probably do not need to use transaction log failover if you don't need two-phase commit with automatic completion of inbound transactions, or if you're not using SIBUS, or if you're not using memory-to-memory state replication, perhaps you don't need to call EJBs. If you're not doing any of those, then you can actually turn off the HA manager itself for a core group. So any application that's not using those services, you can define a special core group for them and put those application servers into that special core group and turn off the HA manager service. Now, in that special core group, you can grow that as big as you want because the HA manager is turned off and none of the communication and memory overheads that we talked about would apply to that special core group. So you should create bridges, like we talked about, between the core groups, instead of increasing the size of the core group. If you are running into many, many different core groups or a large core group, then you also want to consider creating additional JVMs so that you can host the bridge access point and the core group coordinator in that particular JVM, and that would alleviate some of the functions that of the HA manager into that special JVM rather than imposing additional overhead on the regular application server. Another issue that we have today with core groups in 6.1 is that one of the members of the core group must be a node agent or a deployment manager. And what this means is that as you grow the number of application servers to beyond 50 on a node, you start to run out of node agents. So you might consider creating phantom node agents so that you can put those node agents into the additional core groups. Now, this is a point in time statement because we are looking into resolving this issue for the next. Okay, so going on to page 19, this is just a overall bigger picture view of partitioning yourself, that once you start to create a large number of application servers, then you need to create multiple core groups, and then you bridge them together through the access point group. Okay? So to summarize on page 20, all the members of your workload management cluster must be members of the same core group. So if you define clusters and you deploy applications to those clusters, every cluster member must be part of the same core group. And currently, like we said, there's a requirement that you should only have that you need to have a administrative process, a node agent or D manager to be part of that core group. So that restriction, like I said, we're trying to remove in a future release. You cannot define core groups outside of different ends of the firewall. You can group them, you can bridge them together, but the members of the core group must be inside the same side of the firewall. The members of the core group should be located inside the same local area network because of the Harvey requirements that we talked about. And unless there is a special consideration where the wide area network behaves very similar to the local area network, which applies to very, very few customers, that you should not host your core group members outside of the same local area network. And finally, you should bridge your core groups together and create multiple core groups instead of trying to grow your core group into a big size. Okay, so that completes our discussion about HA manager and core groups. Let's move on to page 21. So starting from page 21, we are going to be talking about some best practices from the system administration point of view. So the first thing that comes to mind is a program model for JMX and how that is affected by a large topology. So as we said before, you go through the deployment manager to issue JMX operations or commands in order to manage yourself. Now, one of the first things that you do when you connect to the deployment manager, if you're doing scripting or if you're writing a Java client, is to perform a query on some members or some mbeings that reside in the cell. Now, the mbeing queries could contain wildcards, and what a wildcard means is that you can actually query for the results of more than one mbeing. Now, the effect of the wildcard is that depending on the parameter that is specified, that the deployment manager can actually send a query out to the node agent, and then from the node agent send that query out to the application server. So in the worst case, let's say that you're trying to query for an endpoint that resides on the deployment manager, for example, the app management endpoint. If your query actually has a wildcard where it's looking for a endpoint whose type is application management followed by the wildcard, it means that the deployment manager will send a query out to all the node agents and to all the application servers. So instead of having the query come back very quickly from the deployment manager, you actually have to wait for the deployment manager to send out all those requests. So let's assume that the time to get the ending on the deployment manager is 1, and then if you have 100 servers, then you actually have to wait for 100 different communications before that result will come back. So the difference between 1 and 100 is a 2 orders of magnitude. And of course, this gets worse if you have an even larger topology. If you have a 1,000 servers, right, then it becomes 3 orders of magnitude slower. So what this means is that for you, when you are trying to query for an endpoint, you should be aware of the target of where that endpoint resides, and you should try to narrow that query as much as possible so that you can narrow down where that query will go. So if you're querying for a node agent endpoint and you know which node that endpoint is, then you should specify the additional query parameters in order for you to target the queries for that node. So let's say that you want to find the node agent endpoint for node 1. In your query, you specify that, then you will be able to allow the deployment manager to narrow that communication and send that only to node 1, and instead of sending that to all of the other nodes. If you're looking for some ending on a particular node, a particular server, again, you should narrow that down. So as an example, let's say that you're trying to query for some application ending on application server 1 in node 1, then you should narrow that query. And then in that case, the deployment manager would be able to get to there in 2 hops, from the D manager to the node to the server, rather than having to go through all the different hops, 1 or 2 order of magnitude number of hops in order to get a result back. In version 6.1, we actually had quite a few internal components that are using YQuery and were causing performance problems as you create larger and larger environments. So we believe that we have those problems fixed. However, we cannot fix the queries that you issue outside of the WASP runtime, and therefore we need to discuss this as the best practice to use in order to allow you to create a higher performing set of queries and be able to manage them more efficiently. Okay, going on to slide number 22. So in addition to the YJMX queries, there are a few other issues that we need to consider in this large topology environment. One of them is the node sync interval, and the other one is the application server ping interval. So the node sync interval is the interval that we alluded to earlier in this presentation, through which the node agent will come in to perform periodic synchronization with the deployment manager. So as the number of nodes increases, the default interval of 1 minute should be increased in order to not overload the deployment manager with additional traffic for node sync. And like I said before, you also might want to consider turning off node sync altogether and just rely on your configuration operation to decide when the node sync should be performed. If you do not perform configuration operations frequently, then turning off node sync altogether would also benefit you in terms of reducing the amount of CPU and network traffic. And then the other tuning parameter that could be performed is between the node agent and the application server. The node agent actually performs a periodic sync of the application servers. And as you increase the number of application servers in the node, the number of pings that the node agent would have to perform increases. And so this would actually put a dent on the amount of network traffic and also the amount of CPU that the node agent has to use in order to monitor the application servers. The trade-off here is that as you increase the ping interval, you might not get feedback as early in terms of when the application servers are misbehaving. Going on to slide number 23, in terms of security considerations, the biggest impact for a large topology is how frequently the user registry is accessed during a login. And the other impact is actually the amount of time that is used during SSL handshake. So if you're in a smaller topology, it might not matter as much because your user registry might be able to handle a smaller node. However, as you increase your cell size, you do want to reduce the number of times that you access your user registry so that you don't overload it. So the recommendation here is that if you're using a proxy server and you are performing the authentication on the proxy server itself, then there's no reason for WASP process to perform that authentication again. So you want to make sure that you set up the traffic association interceptors on the application server so that a login does not happen for a second time. Another recommendation is that if you are using 6.1.0.9 or later, which is actually available already, that you might want to consider turning on a few security configuration attributes. The first one, propagate first caller only, what it does is that it only puts the first caller into the security attribute propagation token. It does not put additional callers at the caller context switches. And this actually improves performance because it does not incur the additional overhead of the additional context security context switches. And for most applications, only the first caller is required for auditing and logging purposes. Now, if you do not need to log information about context switches or host changes, you can actually disable that altogether by setting the disable propagation caller list configuration attribute to be true. And finally, if you are interested in reducing the number of SSL handshakes, then you can tune the ORB keep alive parameter to be true, and that would reduce the number of handshakes because sometimes when you have the idle session, that the handshake might take place, and by turning this on, it would reduce the number of those handshakes. Going on to slide number 24, DOS considerations. So as many of you know, the DOS environment already offers a number of high availability functions, including the Z Workload Manager, the Z Automatic Restart Manager, the Z Resource Recovery Service. And WebSphere actually makes use of many of these services in its implementation of the application server runtime. The HA Manager is used on Z only for those services where they depend on the HA Manager itself. So the services that we talked about for memory-to-memory replication, singleton failover of transaction logs, if you're using two-phase, on-demand routing, SI-bus, and WebSphere workload management. This is not the same as the Z workload management. This would be the case where if you are using Z as a client to talk to a workstation, WebSphere workload management, EJB, for example. Then if you're using these services, then HA manager will be used on C. Going on to slide number 25, in terms of the recommendations for ZOS, if you are not using the services that require HA manager, just like workstation, you should disable the HA manager service. Or just like workstation, you can create different groups, core groups, such that some of the core groups are disabled for HA manager, and then other core groups are running the HA manager. So far, we have not seen that many require the use of HA manager on Z. However, as we start to use more of the HA manager services for WebSphere XD, we might start to see more of those. So again, you want to configure the number of servers according to the number, the amount of memory that you have available. And that if you want hardware redundancy, which you do, then you want to use more than one LPAR per cell so that if one of the LPAR goes down, you still have the other LPAR as the backup. There's a way on Z to make the D manager restartable on any LPAR. So what you do is that you use a shared file system to store the configuration of the deployment manager. And then after that, you should be able to restart the deployment manager from any LPAR. Okay, so let's finish this presentation with some sample topologies that we have seen in the field that customers are using. These are not necessarily the largest topologies. They are larger ones, but these are representative of some of the larger ones that we have seen recently. So on page 26, there is a sample workstation topology where a customer has 600 application servers. There's one D manager node. There are seven application server nodes. And because the number of core groups, there are seven empty nodes so that it could be used to create multiple core groups. If you recall, each of the core groups must have at least a node agent or D manager as a core group member. And of course, there's only one D manager, and it's probably better not to run the D manager inside a core group anyway. So so for this particular scenario, we create seven empty nodes so that the node agent could become part of the core group. And there are 14 core groups and 14 clusters. So this is a topology that's actually in a real customer environment, and it is running today. Going on to page 27, similarly on Z, this is from a real customer environment that's running. Like I said, the HA manager itself is not seeing in as many Z topologies, although the number of usages is increasing. So for this sample topology, the HA manager is disabled. There are two different LPARs. There's one WAS node per LPAR, which means that there are actually only two nodes. And there's one D manager configure that's restartable from each of the LPAR. And there are 600 application servers with 300 application servers running on each WAS node. Okay, and this concludes the presentation.
Thank you, Michael, for a great presentation.
And we have a question from Thomas Mulzawiski from Citi.
Hello?
Hi.
Okay. My question is, you mentioned that various components have different complexity, linear, quadratic, and so on. And also that the HA manager has the quadratic complexity. Are there any other components we should be aware of, or any other complexity we should be aware of for the subcomponents?
The HA manager is the main component that we introduced today that has the complexity that we're talking about. The different components that uses the HA manager, they each have their own additional best practices and different ways of using the HA manager, which in some cases would make them behave better, in other cases make them behave a little bit worse. So this large topology work group is ongoing, and we will have updates about the best practices for each of the components that use HA manager. In addition to that, there are other components that do not use HA manager specifically, but they might have impact in terms of web SEER topology. So I talk about systems management a little bit in terms of the programming best practices and configuring timeouts and so on. We believe that there are other areas of systems management in terms of configuration management and application management. You know, how fast can I deploy an application as I increase the number of applications, or how large can my application get, or if I want to create, you know, 1,000 servers, how much time should I take, or does it take? So those kinds of issues are not depending on HA manager, but these are issues that we do want to continue to investigate.
Now, for the HA manager dependent components, do they use HA manager for all their communication, or do they try to do communication between each other without HA manager?
The components that depend on HA manager, they depend on the underlying communication protocol, the DCS and RMM. So that's the fundamentals for those components.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Melissa Hubbard with Highmark.
Hi. My question is about the HA manager and the core group topologies that you have on slides 16 and 17. I was wondering, does this assume that all the applications are in one cell? And is there another, I mean, are there other recommendations for if there are multiple cells?
You can actually put your application in multiple cells and bridge them together across cells. So that is usable.
Okay, so you would still use these core group access points?
Yes, you can define a core group access point the same way as before, except that in the configuration there is an external reference allow you to create an external reference to a different cell.
Okay. And then I also had just one other question too. You had mentioned that you can turn off the HA manager if you're not calling an EJB or something like that. What would happen if you did shut off the HA manager and you were calling an EJB? Would it still work, or?
It depends on it depends on the topology that you're in. So let's say that if you're an application client, you're not inside any cell, right? You're just a regular J2E client.
Okay.
It actually does not use the HA manager. What it does is that you bootstrap to one of the node agents, and then you get the routing information from the node agent, and then as you're calling the EJBs, you will get updated information, not as fast as using the HA manager. There's no HA manager on the application client. So if you're a pure application client, it will work. It just doesn't react as fast to the changes in the topology. If you're inside the application server and you're making a call through workload management to an application and you turn off the HA manager itself, I don't think that it actually works all that. I don't think that it actually works because the routing information doesn't get propagated between the different members of your environment. But I'm not 100% sure about that. So I think what I need to do is to double check with the workload management team to make sure that indeed that this will not work. But
okay.
From what I've seen so far, it will not work. At least not that well.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Jayant Thomas with AT&T.
Hi, my question is, what do you recommend? We have an environment where we have two cells. So the main reason for that is to give us high availability during deployments. Is that a good approach? Or
you have two different cells, and you want to make it highly available for deployment?
So we have one deployment manager and two different cells. So the main reason we have is to we can take down one cell and deploy the new release. And, you know, that's the architecture we have. Do you think that's a good one? Or?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, a deployment manager can only manage one cell.
The deployment manager cannot manage two cells? We have a Not the deployment manager. We have the network dispatcher.
Yes. Okay. So that's good. So a network dispatcher, yes, you can use that to dispatch to two different cells to worry about availability or isolation, right? Or if you want to have the two cells be in a different geographic area, right? You can certainly do that.
Okay.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. Our next question comes from Ramji Chapita from AT&T.
Oh, hi, this is Ramji, and I have actually three questions. The first question is, we talked the component DCS under HA Manager, and we use DCS Secure. I mean, can you throw a light on how that works on the HA Manager part?
I'm not familiar enough with the underlying DCS implementation to be able to answer that. What I can do is I can take down a question and then get back to you.
Yeah, I would really appreciate that.
Okay. Could you give me your name again?
Ramji, R-A-M-J-E-E.
Okay.
And my email is rc5145@att.com.
rc5145@att.com?
That's right.
Okay, I will take it to do to get that answer for you.
Okay. And my next question is, our each application components are deployed onto each application server, and we have the clustered and clones on that particular cluster. And in the cluster, we enable preferred local and also enable high availability for persistent services. And I was just wondering what is the best practices in terms of this.
Okay, so the best practice is to enable preferred local because what it means is that if the two applications reside in the same process, or if the caller and callee reside in the same process, then you will call into the same JVM, and then you don't incur the overhead of going out of the process itself.
Right. And each application is deployed on application server itself, individual application servers.
If each application, let's say application A is on application, well,
server A.
Right, and then application B is on application server B.
That's right.
Then preferred local won't get you anything, right, because it would have to go across the process boundary to call into the other application server.
Well, I mean, if we have two or more nodes, would that help?
If you have two or more nodes, that doesn't get you the benefit, right? You have to actually make them code okayed in the same process.
Okay. Yeah. How about the enabling high availability for persistent services?
So high availability for persistent, there are different ways to do this depending on what you're doing for your application.
Right.
So I'm assuming that you have a web app and you are using HTTP session state, then you have different choices. If you use the domain replication service, then that does require the HA manager. For the web application, you also have another choice, which is to use a database, and in that case, you need to use a database, but it means that you don't have to use the overhead of the HA manager itself. If you're running EJBs and you are using stateful session beings and you need to persist that, I think that today you have the option of using a DRS only to replicate that session state.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And one more thing is that we have two different data centers and we are sharing one Oracle backend. And we have, I think I'm fine with that. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Michael Killalay with Cigna.
Hi, this is Mike Killalay with Cigna. I noticed through the presentation a lot of emphasis was given to tuning the HA manager as a means to prevent a lot of chatter between the components in the cell. If this tuning were to be applied and we're counting on security attribute propagation, can we break our security attribute propagation by applying tuning parameters to the HA manager?
No, I mean, these are two different infrastructures, and the security attribute propagation does not really rely on the HA manager itself. So these are different and independent tunings.
Okay, so we could, if we didn't require DRS or any of the services like session persistence, we could disable the HA manager, and that would not affect our security attribute proposition.
Correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And there are no further questions. I'd like to turn the conference back over to you, Ms. Kuhn, for any additional or closing remarks.
At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the Webster Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thank you very much for joining us. And again, Michael, thank you for presenting today.
Thank you.